If you will, turn with me to Luke, the 19th chapter. It's an interesting statement that Jesus made in the 40th verse. There was criticism being offered by some of the Pharisees, and from the multitudes, I assume as well as some of the Pharisees, about the disciples of Jesus. They said in the 39th verse, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." And he answered and said, "I tell you that if these shall hold their peace, the stones will cry out." I want to take that passage out of context and do what an author years ago did with it, Harry Rimmer, and talk in terms of the historicity of the Bible under the rubric, "The stones cry out." The fact of the matter is, there are two kinds of evidences that manifest themselves in Scripture. One of these is personal testimony. And in the final analysis, everything in Scripture is the result of personal testimony. However, that personal testimony was offered in time and space, in certain places, at certain given occasions. And therefore, the very physical elements themselves, the land in which they lived, the people who ruled during the time that they spoke, the great events that were happening concurrently with their lives, all cry out as testimony as well. And this is basically what we refer to as history in our curricula today. And I would like, therefore, to talk about God as the God of history, who reveals himself in history, or as the one who has come down to man in time and space. And I hope that the things that we say will be of significance. When we talk about God being the God of history, we're saying something that is very unique about the God of the Bible. Because the truth of the matter is, there aren't any of the other world religions that do this. Now, I've already excluded from that package the Islamic religion, because it really is a kind of a building on the coattails of Judaism and Christianity. And therefore, it subscribes, to some extent at least, to the historical narratives of the Old and the New Testament, though it reinterprets them at will. But when you talk in terms of New Age religion here in the United States, or you talk in terms of Eastern religions of various kinds, they are really non-historical. I want you to realize that the way pagans, one and all, view time is not the same as we view time. I don't mean by that that they don't click off the seconds of a watch like we do, but they see time in a cyclical fashion, as just simply going round and round. And basically, this old chart is a summation of some materials that were presented years ago in a book called The Shape of the Past by John Ward Montgomery. Such things as the nature cycles, where whatever is happening each year is going to happen the next year and the next year and the next year. The teachings of the Epicureans in the time of the Apostle Paul, or even today, the Big Bang Theory. I know that some individuals have gotten into trouble for saying that the Big Bang Theory is the friend of the Bible. Well, I think I understand what the men who are saying this mean. What they're simply saying is, this at least is an admission that there is some kind of beginning for what is here at the present time. And in that sense, it is a friendly starting point for a discussion with those with whom we disbelieve. But the Big Bang Theory is not the fact that this just happens once forever. It is something that really involves a whole series of expansions and contractions of these explosions. And so in reality, when you get down to the heart of the matter, the Big Bang Theory is not much different than the pagan cyclical view of time. On the other hand, history is going somewhere with respect to the Bible. There is a beginning, creation. There is an end. There will be judgment. And as far as our time-space continuum is concerned, as far as history is concerned, that will be it. Before this time, there is eternity. Beyond this time, eternity continues. And here we are in this phase of history, however long it may still last. But this is absolutely unique, that we have come from some place as a starting point, that we are presently on our way somewhere, and that eventually there will be a consummation, a climax, an end of history as we know it here upon this earth. As far as the Easterners are concerned, they climb on the wheel of rebirth and go round and round and round and round, and it never ends. That is a fundamental concept that I think that we need to understand. That when we're going to talk to somebody about the Bible, we really are not starting with Easterners on the same page. And somehow that has to be clarified if we're ever going to get anywhere in a discussion. The Bible records God's self-revelation in history. It describes the acts of God, but it also interprets the acts of God. And often these interpretations are declared to be God's own self-interpretations. Let's take, for instance, the crossing of the Jordan River. Up in the upper reaches of the Jordan River, it is very narrow. This is a country in which they have earthquakes. And it would not be an unthinkable thing. In fact, I think there can be parallels in ancient history in which there was an earthquake and the river flow was blocked so that basically the river pretty much dried up downstream. And so when the Israelites came to the brink of the River Jordan, was there an earthquake up around Mount Hermon in Lebanon so that the water flow was cut off and the river dried up? Was it just merely a matter of chance or circumstance? Or did God do this? I would say, I don't think that there is any way for me to know the answer to that with my visible naked eye. However, God tells me that He did it. And I believe that He did it. Because when I put that statement in the larger context of the entire Bible, it makes eminently good sense. Because it isn't just one thing that happened to the Israelites. Something similar happened at the Red Sea. There was the long day of Joshua. And I could go on and on recounting incidents that took place. Now, some people are lucky. But a whole nation of people don't engage in incidents of luck like that time and time and time and time and time and time again. So that at the least it is reasonable to believe God's interpretation that he did that. And I certainly do believe it. Revelation is disclosed to each of us in time and space. In our world, we live in an age of astronauts. And it's amazing at how you can come to be so close to something like that. When I was teaching years ago, I was standing on a sidewalk in front of a boys' dormitory, speaking with a group of men. There was a full moon, and I alerted their attention. I said, look up there. I said, it's hard for me to believe that the man who is piloting the ship that is orbiting the moon is a fellow that I went to high school with. Today, our daughter, though it's a menial task, is a tile tech. When the ships go out and come back in, she checks out the tiles to make sure that if any are damaged, that they need to be replaced and that they need to be refurbished. And so she has, in essence, a kind of a living contact with this aspect of the space age. I would have ever dreamed when I was a boy watching Buck Rogers that these realities would take place. But as far as the astronauts go into outer space, the only way they can do it is to take our space with them. God made mankind to dwell on the earth. And we do that very well. We can take most of the atmospheric conditions on this earth, but when we get too far afield, we're in trouble. And when we lose our sense of time and space, we are definitely in trouble. But God has accommodated us. There's no way that we can break out of this space-time continuum. There's no way that we can just jump up to God. Mystics have tried that for years. They make the boast that somehow they have these extra body experiences and that they in reality become one with God. There is no way in the world to verify that if it were true. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You cannot verify that with any of the sense experiences. The fact of the matter is, the Bible suggests that in a new, unique way, God has come down to man. Now, we're familiar with that. He did it at Mount Sinai. And sometimes read that vivid description over in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 21. You have come unto a mount that that might be touched. But if you touched it, it was a fearsome situation. You will be thrust through with a dart. You will be killed if you touch the mount. And when God spoke, his voice thundered forth from Sinai, and it was so awesome that the people begged Moses to plead with God not to speak to them directly anymore. And I hear folks talk about just kind of communicating with God, and he just talks to them in a fatherly sort of way. I want to tell you what. I'm just not sure they understand what they're talking about. They may have a psychological impression that that's the case, and it's real with them. But when I read the account of what happened when God spoke to men, when I see Moses at the burning bush, and God says, take your shoes off your feet. The ground whereon you stand is holy ground. Then it gives me pause. He came down in Jesus Christ. John's gospel begins. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. But then he goes on to suggest the fact that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory. The glory is that the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. In the 18th verse, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him. God indeed has come down. When Jesus was raised from the dead, He said on more than one occasion, "See my hands. See the nail-pierced hole in my side. Reach forth your finger, Thomas, and thrust your finger into my side. And be not faithless, but believe." Thomas had said, "Unless I see with my eyes, unless I'm able to put my finger into the print of the nails, I will not believe." He was a hard-nosed empiricist. And we can be thankful that he was. I think the truth of the matter is most of us would have been exactly the same way. But Jesus did not flinch. He accommodated his disciple because he knew that that is the way God made men to think and to act. And he said, "Look with your eyes, touch with your hands." And notice there that there is the matter of the two sense perceptions. Because our senses deceive us at times. And we often need a multiple of sense perceptions in order to help give us a sense of certainty. And I could go on with regard to that. In the Gospel of Luke, all that is said in the Gospel of Luke is rooted in history. For instance, the very introduction to Luke's Gospel. "For as much as many have taken in hand to draw up a narrative concerning those matters which have been fulfilled among us, even as they delivered them unto us, who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, to write you in order, most excellent Theophilus, that you might know the certainty concerning the things wherein you were instructed." As we move over a little bit, we notice that in the second chapter, Luke begins, "Now it came to pass in those days, there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to enroll themselves, everyone to his own city." Now that may present problems for a Bible believer, but it roots the account of the life of Jesus in time and space. These are real people. We know them not only from the biblical record, we know them from the Roman record. We have Caesar Augustus. We have Quirinius, the governor of Syria. And we therefore can get down and work on our chronology and do some history with regard to these particular matters. Look at the third chapter. "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Lysanias tetrarch of Abilene, in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came unto John the son of Zechariah." You don't write mythology this way, because it puts you in a dilemma. Because if you make a mistake, one little mistake, the critics are going to pounce on it. But the biblical authors are not concerned about that, because they simply are the vehicles for the revelation of God, and they are recording these events for the benefit of mankind. I want to spend a little time talking about the bearing of archaeology on the historicity of the biblical text. I'm not naive enough to believe that archaeology solves all of our problems. It does not. Sometimes it complicates the problems. Because it can dig up facts, but it can't always interpret those facts correctly. There is a great deal of human judgment, and a lot of times that human judgment errs. And I want to give a special warning to any young man who is preaching the gospel. Don't make the mistake that I did when I started out. I can remember when I was fresh out of college that I just felt duty-bound to preach all of these grand and glorious sermons on archaeology in the Bible. And I preached things as fact that later on I had to eat as crow. But the sad thing is I had spouted them out as fact and did not have the opportunity to go back and take it back. Archaeology is a human science. It is fraught with a great number of frailties and failures. And everything is not positive. But now, having said that, archaeology is certainly a science that corroborates biblical history from time to time. In fact, here is a statement that is made by an author named Miller Burroughs. Miller Burroughs was in reality a theological liberal. He didn't even believe the Bible was inspired. But listen to what he said. On the whole, such evidence as archaeology has afforded thus far, especially providing additional and older manuscripts of the books of the Bible, strengthens our confidence in the accuracy with which the text has been translated through the centuries. Not only the main substance of what was written, but even the words, aside from minor variations, have been transmitted with remarkable fidelity. So that there need be no doubt whatever regarding the teaching of the Bible personalities. I think that that's a refreshing comment coming from someone who is so critical of the biblical text himself. But I want to take a little different approach maybe than might often be taken in the study of the, shall we say, corroboration of biblical history. And I'm going to take a model that comes from classical archaeological studies. I mean, the archaeologists that dig up the remains of the ancient Greeks and Romans. They suggest to us that there are three areas that come to us from ancient times for our investigation. One of these is a body of traditions. And I'm going to put the Bible in there. Now please understand what I mean by this. There is inspired tradition and there is uninspired tradition. Tradition just simply means this is something that has been handed down from generation to generation to generation. Some of these books of the Bible are very old, and therefore, having come down to us, they have come down to us traditionally. Then there are inscriptions. Some of these inscriptions stand above ground, and you can take a trip over there today and you can read those inscriptions. One of the most fascinating places in the world is the Dog River Valley in Lebanon. I had an opportunity back in 1969 to go there. Might not be safe to make that trip in this day and age. But you can walk through that canyon and be fascinated because up on the walls are these inscriptions that were put there by nearly every major general of an ancient army. From the pharaohs of Egypt, down through the kings of Assyria and of Babylon, down even to one of the generals of the First World War. Because that was one of the few places that you could move yourself easily through the Lebanon Mountains. It was a mountain pass. And here they stand, weathered but readable after all of these centuries, as inscriptional testimony. Others are dug up from the earth. They were hidden there for hundreds, even thousands of years, and they've come to light. And then there are the material remains, where we actually not only dig up whole cities, but we dig up ancient wedding rings, or we dig up a plate that is full of dried up food when perhaps there had been a volcanic eruption and this was just frozen in time, so to speak, or burned, etched in time, as the circumstance might mean. We also need to realize that what is reflected in one of these sources may not necessarily be reflected in either of the other two. We have a lot of traditions that we have no inscriptions that verify, or we have no material remains that substantiate what is said in the traditions. But nobody particularly questions the tradition. It doesn't mean that if I dig up an old city and there is not some story about that city on record that the city didn't exist. Or that if I read about an ancient city but we can't find any physical remains of that city that the city didn't exist. It is just taken as an assumption that generally speaking people are truthful. And that unless it is an obvious context of mythology, admittedly so by the authors themselves, that we take seriously what is being said. But the bottom line is that unconfirmed traditions of antiquity are not automatically suspect. And we need to indelibly imprint that on our minds. We give the benefit of the doubt to the document. If that weren't so, few people would ever inherit anything. We just operate on the assumption that if a person was of their reasonable mind and they left a will, that that will is to be executed according to the dictates of that person. We don't just automatically assume, well, somebody's forged this document so they can get part of the estate. Now, does that happen at times? Oh, yes, it happens at times. Does it happen in the majority of cases? Why, absolutely not. It doesn't happen in the majority of cases. And we give the benefit of the doubt. What we really are interested in is maximum corroboration. Sometimes there will be an inscription that verifies a tradition. Sometimes there will be a material remain that corroborates an inscription. But what we want is that number seven. We want all three of these concentric circles to overlap. We want not only to read about it in the tradition, we want to see it with our eyes in the inscription, and we want to be able to touch it with respect to material remains. And when we can do that, then it is considered to be historically corroborated almost beyond question. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at some things that hopefully will help us in this regard. One other general thing before I just cite a few instances. This is very fascinating to me. This is some material that was put out by an author named Yamauchi. He is an American, Oriental by birth, who is one of the finest ancient historians of the Near East that is living today, very conservative in his thinking. But he points out the fact that there is only a small fraction of what is made or written that survives today. Only a very small fraction. And there's only a small fraction of available sites that have been surveyed. And I mean like Jericho or Samaria or any other site. There's only a small fraction of surveyed sites that have been excavated by the archaeologists. And there's only a small fraction of an excavated site that has been examined. And there is only a small fraction of the materials, especially written materials, produced by excavations that have at this point been published. You can go to the University of Chicago and you can go to a back room in the Oriental Institute and you can find wheelbarrows full of cuneiform texts that have never even been read. It takes nearly a lifetime of study to be able with precision to translate those languages. At a minimum, it probably takes a man till he's 40 or 50 years old to be ready to read. And he can only read so many so fast. And then he's dead. How many of you are trained to read ancient cuneiform tablets? I'm certainly not. And neither are there many other people in the world. Now, here is Yamauchi's assessment. If one could, by an overly optimistic estimate, reckon that one-fourth of our materials and inscriptions survived, that one-fourth of the available sites have been surveyed, that one-fourth of the excavated sites have been examined, and that one-fourth of the materials and inscriptions excavated have been published, one would still have less than 1/1,000th of the possible evidence. Realistically speaking, the percentage is no doubt even smaller. Let me give you an illustration. The site of Colossae stands in Asia Minor unexcavated. I have seen it with my naked eye. The reason for that is that there is a farmer that owns the land and he won't give the right to excavate. And his government of Turkey stands behind him. And archaeologists are just in tears because that's the case. But this is where the farmer has more power than the great university professor. What if San Jose were destroyed by a natural disaster or by war? How fragmentary would be the evidence for its existence 1,000 years from now? Native American cultures are constantly being excavated and examined by archaeologists, but the archaeologists are faced with the problem of reconstruction on the basis of fragmentary evidence. There are limits to the corroboration of ancient traditions, and we need to be appreciative of that fact and understand that fact. Now, let me share some examples with you, and we will do this in a very cursory fashion, but I hope in such a way that it will be of some interest to you. I want to start out with one of the most fascinating things that I think I have seen in my lifetime. I had the privilege a few years ago of hearing Mr. Kitchen, who is a British Egyptologist, lecture. And he is a very conservative man with regard to his beliefs about the Bible, but he is one of the most noted Egyptologists in the world today, very respected in his scholarship. And obviously, he has done a great deal of study in ancient Near Eastern history and archaeology. And so, he sees things and gleans them out for the study of the Scriptures. I heard him give this lecture on one occasion before an audience much, much larger than this. I suppose there were probably 1,000 people that were in the audience. And most of them were extremely liberal professors of religion that didn't believe the Bible was inspired, period. But here's one of the things that he gave in that. This has since been printed in this Biblical Archaeology Review back in 1995. What we have here is a graph of the price of slaves in the ancient world. Now, these have been gleaned from the ancient documents, the traditions. For instance, you have here the timelines, 2000 BC, 1750, 1500, 1250, 1000, and so on. And here is what we have. Back here, you have the Akkadian dynasty, and the price of slaves was a little over 10 silver shekels. And you move over to the third dynasty of Ur of the Chaldees. And the price of slaves hasn't changed. Though you have moved probably 400 years, or no, not that much, maybe 200 years in time. Then you come to the New Babylonian period, and you've gone, what, a couple of hundred years anyway, and the price is raised to 20 shekels. And then you come on over to Nuzi, to another ancient city-state, and the price has gone up to 30 shekels, and then over to Ugarit, and it is still 30 shekels. You come on up to the time of the Assyrians, at the time of Menahem, the king of Israel, in 2 Kings 15:20, and the price of a slave has risen to about 50 shekels, if I can read that on this angle, until you get to the Persian period, and you really see inflation, it was 120 silver shekels. Now, what in the world's the significance of that? Well, here's the significance of it. There are three instances in which we have the price of slaves talked about. When Joseph is sold as a slave. Over in the Sinai Covenant, it talks about the price of slaves. And over here in the time of Menahem, king of Israel, we have the price of slaves discussed. Now, here's the point. At the time that Moses said Joseph is supposed to have lived, the price of slaves that is recorded is what is to be expected. The same is true at the Sinai covenant. The same is true over here. Now, do you realize that as far as liberal critics are concerned, they don't believe that this was written until way after this time, maybe up in here somewhere. And the point is pretty obvious. These men would have had absolutely no way to know the price of slaves at those earlier periods of history. Now, this is an undesigned coincidence of the Bible. But when it is checked with the references that are available to us, this kind of information is duplicated over and over and over again. I want, because of the time constraints, only to give you one other illustration. And if the tape runs out, so be it. This is an absolutely fascinating illustration, if I can find it. I'm not sure I can. I thought I had these lined up. Sometimes I lose them, and well, I have no idea what I have done with this. I can't believe this. Maybe this is it. No? Now let me fumble here for one more second and see if I can locate. If I have failed to bring it, that is just the way it is. And I think I have. Harry, would you hand me that folder? I'm bound to have it. I just, for some reason, didn't get it out. Here it is, right here. Here it is, right here. There is in the Bible, in Isaiah, the 20th chapter, and the first verse, this simple statement. In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him and fought against Ashdod and took it. The problem with that simple little statement of scripture is the fact that 100 years ago, there was absolutely no record that Sargon ever existed. They had ancient king lists of the Assyrians, but there was no mention of Sargon in there. Well, immediately the conclusion was drawn that this is a purely mythological character that was created in the minds of the biblical authors. Until, in 1843, an archaeologist excavated a palace at Khorsabad and found out, to his dismay, that it was the palace of Sargon, king of Assyria. And what you're looking at is a bas-relief of this ancient king. Well, not only is that true, but in 1963, the very city of Ashdod was excavated by archaeologists, and guess what? They found the fragments of a victory marker, monument, that had been set up in the city of Ashdod by the armies of this very king, Sargon, which suggests that Isaiah really did know what he was talking about. And a whole group of people that wrote books for about a 50-year span of time had egg on their face because they just automatically assumed, well, we don't have any verification of this in the ancient Assyrian writings, so it must not be true. I want you to understand from all of this one simple concluding point. All human beings are like grass. They come and they go. Like the grass, they wither and die. But the word of the Lord endures forever. And this is the word which by the gospel is being preached.